at the end of the day, it became the chip on my shoulder. You know, I felt that I had something to prove, that without a degree from Harvard or a PhD from somewhere, that I could be extremely successful.
Hello and welcome, everyone. I am Jory Calkins, the founder and CEO of Enduring Companies and the host of Built to Outlast, a podcast and community for business builders by business builders. We explore the journeys and companies of business builders in America with a focus on traditional small to mid-sized business niches and the strategies which enable them to endure and flourish. If you are building a business now or aspire to build one in the future, this is for you. To join the Built to Outlast community and access episodes, show notes, and other community resources to support your journey, please visit builttooutlast.com. If you have or know a business that may be sold and care who the buyer is, or if you want to buy or build a business and care who you do it with, please visit enduring.co to learn more about us, our long-term approach, and our holding company. Welcome, everyone, for our show today. We're speaking with Jonathan Chan, who's a friend and who is the owner of Archfellow LLC and the youngest first-generation Asian-American owner and operator of McDonald's in the U.S., based here in the Dallas area. Welcome to the show, Jonathan.
Hey, thanks for having me, Jory.
I've been looking forward to this conversation for many weeks, if not months, so I'm super excited to get into it. And I think a great spot to start, especially with you and where we start all these episodes, is just hearing about who you are and where you're from, and would love for you to start at hour five or day five or month five or year five, wherever you're most comfortable starting and whatever you think is relevant, but would love to hear who you are and how you grew up and where you came from.
First of all, I love your podcast. I think you have some amazing guests, and I was very hesitant always because of that inferiority complex, but I'll do my best today. So I'll go back to kind of where it all started, which is in California, born and raised in Los Angeles, specifically Arcadia, California, for those that know. My parents are both from Hong Kong, so I'm Cantonese. You know, I grew up, it's technically first generation Asian American, but my parents were actually educated here in the US. And so I kind of grew up like a second generation Asian American, not really speaking Chinese at home. I've been trying to really assimilate within the community. But, for my parents, very culturally aware that my father being the oldest of eight brothers and sisters, and the first to actually immigrate to the U.S., which he has an incredible story on his own. But within the family, it was really important that he, being the oldest son, that his son, which that's me, I'm the oldest boy cousin. I really had to do so much to carry the name forward. And so there was a lot of pressure to go to a good school or get a good job. And I actually decided to do the complete opposite, which was not necessarily go to a good school and, just try to have to find my way. So essentially, to tell you the story, grew up being kind of a rebel in high school and going to Cal Poly Pomona, which was not considered a good school in my family. My older sister, one sibling, went to, Berkeley, UCLA. All my cousins kind of did the same route of being overachievers and going to Ivy League schools. And for me to not go down the path of being in med school or being some sort of professional, getting my master's degree, was a huge embarrassment to my parents. And so from that point, I was given, one or two years to kind of figure it out. And I thought that starting my own business while living at home, not having too many expenses, was kind of the best opportunity, just because if I failed, I'd be able to still get a job. I was young and didn't have a lot of liabilities. So right out of college, I started my first company, which was a cell phone, I don't know what you would call it now, content management company. So we built a software to manage cell phone stores and snowballed that into another company and then ultimately to being a McDonald's owner operator.
Well, that, I feel like you just covered a whole ton of territory in about 10 words. So I'm going to slow you down. What, going back to your kind of family and growing up, I'm similarly the kind of oldest brother and sibling. So I, you know, kind of understand a little bit of what you're talking about, but I think there's even more probably layers to it for you than there is for me in terms of expectations, you know, in the Asian American community and maybe some of the specifics of how you grew up. So can you tell me a little bit more about, you know, you mentioned embarrassment, you mentioned education, and you mentioned, you know, being motivated then to do something entrepreneurial. So can you distill a little bit more kind of that experience for yourself? And what of that experience do you think has stuck with you as, you know, kind of motivators or definitions of self? Or I'd love to peel back that growing up experience more, because it feels like there's a lot there that drives a lot of who you are. And I'm excited to get to the journey of what that has meant, but I want to, you know, understand the core of you as well first.
I guess I'll take you back a little bit. I was never really good at school, like academics. I didn't really participate too much in any extracurricular. I was really never forced to do much either. I don't think that I had the accountability around being in sports in high school or even, you know, getting good grades. I think that they realized that the more that my parents pushed me, the more I would resist. And so the way that they understood how to kind of be supportive was just to agree and try their best to accept. But what didn't help, I guess, was this idea that what they valued was still a good education and a very, you know, stable path of being a doctor or being a lawyer or being someone that had a PhD. My older sister did that. You know, she became an optometrist and she was always praised and promoted and in such a great way. And, you know, I always kind of felt like the black sheep of the family. And, you know, that I guess would just get exacerbated because, you know, out of all my aunts and uncles on my dad's side, you know, they valued the same thing, going to Ivy League schools, you know, my cousin going to Princeton and Yale and Harvard and, you know, something that they always attached to their value of, oh my gosh, look at where my son went and look at where he's at now and look at what he's doing. And my dad never really had that opportunity. You know, every time that we would get together for family reunions, I clearly remember that, you know, for me, it was always, what's your son doing now? I'm not really sure. You know, he's just kind of dabbling in different things. And, or, you know, where is he going to college? You know, that was always probably a conversation that they avoided. You know, and even to a point where I didn't even go to my college graduation. I don't have any photos of me being in a gown from a college graduation. So that's the extent of it. But at the end of the day, it became the chip on my shoulder. You know, I felt that I had something to prove, that without a degree from Harvard or a degree from or a PhD from somewhere, that I could be extremely successful. And I guess I defined success at the time as financial success. And so those are kind of the badges that I carried with me into my professional career.
Thank you for sharing all that. There's a lot there. I feel like every child, and in particular, probably son, and particularly in particular, the oldest son, you know, kind of wants to make their parents proud. And it sounds like that's a massive, I think it's a huge motivator for everyone, and in particular you, and you found a way to kind of make that into a chip on your shoulder and a motivator, which is pretty powerful. How did that kind of chip on your shoulder manifest into doing something entrepreneurial? So you started describing your, you know, the mobile phone content management business, but what was the thought process that got you to, oh, I should go start my own thing, as opposed to, you know, why don't I go do something more mainstream? It was that an act of desperation, or was that an act of control, or was that an act of wanting to be contrarian? What was the kind of like line between that led to that?
You know, just to give some more texture, I married my high school sweetheart. This year will be 29 years together.
Congrats.
And Thank you. Her parents were actually not professionals, and you know, they have a better immigrant story, but they were entrepreneurs themselves, and they are in the watch business, and they owned a couple of watch retail stores in Los Angeles. And you know, growing up with her in high school, I think part of my journey was always kind of going to work with her. You know, like she had to help her parents out on the weekends, and I just kind of tagged along because I wanted to be with her. And so that was sort of a catalyst, because in college, I did a bunch of internships. I did some at some really big names like Disney, Morgan Stanley, and those experiences really allowed me to recognize that I didn't want to work at a desk job. You know, I didn't want to work for someone. I had this personality that, you know, even as a child rebelling to authority, it was very difficult for me to take orders or to be told what to do. And so I think without really knowing at the time, I was a budding entrepreneur and felt that being an entrepreneur, being my own boss, was really my only path to success because of how much I struggled with authority in my adolescence.
That's fascinating. In retrospect, we've had obviously different journeys, but I think a similar thread that we share is I don't think I'd be a good like employee. I don't think I'm very good at that for a number of reasons. But it sounds like that you recognize that in yourself fairly early, which takes a good amount of self-awareness. Were there any specific moments where you realized that, or is it kind of a gradual recognition of I need to kind of blaze my own trail?
Yeah, I think it was early on, basically realizing that I would get bored really quickly if I didn't have a lot of things to do. And maybe, you know, at the time I was like, why am I doing this for someone else versus doing this for myself? I think a lot of that kind of common sense to what I was doing just kind of took over.
What was it that led to what was the first business? Content management on mobile phones? What was that? What was that one?
So, you know, it was kind of like a lifeline. You know, out of college, I was trying to figure out what I wanted to do. And at the time, you know, cell phones were all the rage. I remember really the transition from a car phone being this gigantic thing that you would have to carry around, and only the wealthiest people had car phones, and then to the cell phone boom. And the cell phone boom was interesting because that was kind of right at that moment in college, and you know, the flip phone, the Nokias, but you had all of these mom and pops just spring up out of nowhere, and they would sell every different cell phone carrier and carry hundreds of different phones. And I just kind of thought it was a fascinating business because I loved having a cell phone, I think. And it was like new technology, that shift from having a pager. And so, you know, my wife's parents' friend actually owned a cell phone store. And I said, you know, I think I can do that. And they offered me up like a little booth at one of their watch stores. And they said, hey, with zero to no cost, you can open up a cell phone. You could start selling cell phones and cell phone accessories, and we'll give you a little kiosk kind of in one of our stores. And so that's kind of what I did. And, you know, me being the natural marketer, that was my degree. I was like, hey, one way to promote myself and market myself was I wanted a website. And I realized at the time that having a website was so expensive, almost impossible to program for a very small business. You know, there were, like I said, 5, 6, 7 different carriers at the time, Singular Wireless, Verizon, US Cellular, I mean, you name it, and hundreds of different cell phones, and the plans would change all the time. So it was like, you know, at the time there was no such thing as unlimited. It was like 500 minutes, 700 minutes, 1,000 minutes, and they would evolve constantly. And so to have a website built that was always relevant, would cost you hundreds, if not millions of dollars. And for mom and pop, it was just unfeasible. So that's where my brain got thinking. And I said, there's hundreds of mom and pop cell phone stores. Why don't I go and create kind of like a Shopify version of a website builder for these mom and pops? We would essentially populate cell phone data. We would manage their websites for them. They just slap their logos on and we would charge them a monthly fee. And so that's essentially, it evolved from me being a cell phone little kiosk in my wife's parents' watch store to being my own technology company and servicing these mom and pop cell phone stores. That's kind of how my first company came about. I clearly remember it. I said, you know, I was telling my mom, I said, Mom, I'm a salesman. You know, you watch these, you know, movies where, you know, the husband would get up in the morning, put a suit on and take his briefcase. And, you know, that's essentially what I did. I mean, I clearly remember, I said, Mom, I need a nice briefcase. And I spent all this money on this nice briefcase and a nice suit. And I would go and I would just literally drive around LA to every single mom and pop store and try to sell my technology to them. And it was the most, still to this day, one of the most humbling experiences I've ever had. It was really how I learned to deal with rejection and, you know, just being kind of, I don't even know the right adjective to describe it, but being an Asian American and, you know, one of my personality traits is I'm an introvert. And so it was so difficult to come out of that shell to just be brave enough and courageous enough to drive up to a random business, introduce myself and try to sell them something.
That's awesome. I'm generally an introvert as well and have been in similar situations. But for you, I can imagine how strong and deep the motivation and drive was to push you out of that comfort zone and get you doing that. I mean, that's an awesome story. And it sounds like awesome learning for you. So what do you feel like you learned either in that initial kind of having to go out and effectively door knock selling experience or the experience of building that business? Do you have a few kind of like takeaways from that experience that have informed your path going forward in general about business or, you know, specifically about that experience?
Yeah, I think that experience, and I'll go back, my life, I always take in multiples of three. I always give three examples. I always like to have three takeaways. So I'll give you three takeaways. I think number one, it taught me initiative. You know, going to every single cell phone store, knocking on the door, without doing that, I would have never been able to make it happen. So it's initiative initially. Number two, it's relationships. It taught me that the relationship in business matters. And it was the relationships, right, that got me to where I am in terms of even having the opportunity to be, to sell cell phones. It was the relationship that my wife's parents had with their friend that allowed him to bet on me. It was the relationships with my very first customer, them thinking that I was, you know, this young kid that they wanted to support and they wanted to give a try. And then number three, it's kind of what I teach my kids, grit. You know, just that unrelentless, not necessarily the relentless, you know, grit that you need to overcome just rejection. You know, it was probably 6 to 7 months, hundreds of locations before I got my first customer. So,
do you remember that first customer?
I do. It was a mom and pop. And I felt guilty at the time because I felt like an imposter, like I was selling a dream and I convinced them or I cheated them into buying this product that I was also not too confident in.
Why do you think they bought? Do you think they got out of it what they were looking for? Were they looking for the actual product or were they looking, you know?
I think it was twofold. I think they were naive. They had a heart of gold in the sense that their naiveness and their innocence to trying what's new, wanting to be kind of on the cutting edge and believing in a young kid that was hungry to be successful. I think it was a combination of their good faith.
That's awesome. Well, it sounds like they were a little bit purchasing the service and a little bit helping someone that they wanted to help.
Correct.
You know?
Yeah.
Those are impactful lessons, especially, how old were you at that point? Like 20s?
21.
Oh, wow. So early 20s.
Yeah.
So those are like real lessons. I don't think I learned those lessons for certainly, you know, not that early. Tell me about the rest of that journey and then how that evolved into the next stop on the path.
Yeah. So eventually we got enough customers to become a viable business, and it was a new idea. And the way that the industry worked at the time was there was master franchisees that, you know, basically licensed out to all these mom and pops, but it always fed back to one major licensed carrier or distributor for one of the major cell phone companies. And one of them saw my product and thought that it was a good idea to buy my company so that they can do it themselves for the hundreds of franchisees that they had. And so we said, hey, that makes a lot of sense. And so we sold the technology to them and found my way trying to figure out what was the next thing that I wanted to do.
Before you go there, just to pause you, what was that process and moment like? Did you feel like, so selling a business is, you know, probably a lot of emotions. What were those emotions for you, and what was the decision path for you to doing that? Was it an obvious decision or a, you know, one that you stewed on for a while? What, can you walk through that?
For me, I was so young at the time, like 22, 23, if I remember correctly. And it just felt like it was a win. But at the end of the day, I think my undiagnosed ADHD was kicking in. And I realized that I started to get bored. And I didn't like selling product. You know, I didn't like going door to door. I didn't like having to manage clients that paid me month to month. Like, I think selling to a customer that kind of wasn't a repeat customer, dependent on some sort of service, was okay with me ultimately, but I kind of didn't like that side of the business. And so, you know, it just felt like the right thing to do. And, you know, again, at the time, like, I didn't know what that really meant. I was such a small, it was just me. I mean, if you really think about it, I had like, you know, two employees, and it was just me and a team of programmers in, I think it was Ukraine actually at the time. So, you know, again, it was a very small transaction, and it was like, you know, I went to a family lawyer to try to draft some contracts that didn't really know what to do. I mean, so it was a very new experience, and I just felt kind of lucky to kind of get through it. And I think the company that I sold it to knew I was such a novice and very naive about how things worked, and they took advantage of that. That was kind of the emotional experience. I was just like, I guess this is how you do it. And I didn't know any better.
Well, it sounds again like an experience that not everyone gets in a lifetime that you had pretty early on. I think it's also interesting and maybe serendipitous that you interacted with kind of one of these licensee franchisee ecosystems that early on.
Yeah.
Which, you know, at that point in your journey, you might not have been thinking that that was relevant or not. But I think that is kind of serendipitous, if nothing more. And then my other thought is, what was the dialogue and relationship with your parents like at that point? Did you feel like, to me, outside in, it would have felt like putting a huge like win on the board, which is something you were hungry for, maybe or maybe not, that is what it felt like to you. But what did that feel like in terms of the relationship with your parents and father in particular, and, you know, some of the motivators and chip that you had developed kind of out of that formative experience?
It was still at an impasse. I think it was still too insignificant for them to recognize that there was real success there. And instead, it was just part of my journey of survival. I still was living at home, as an example. I was still super young and didn't have necessarily the resources to buy a home or you know, to really do anything more significant, you know, and didn't feel that I had something that was not necessarily tangible, but I would say risk-free and consistent. There was still a lot of uncertainty with what I did. And that, more than anything, continued to reaffirm their belief that being a professional like a doctor or a lawyer was still the better path. And so there was still a lot to prove.
It's pretty interesting, this trade-off. And I see it in pretty much everyone that we have on the show. But this kind of trade-off between autonomy and entrepreneurship and controlling one's destiny with at least perceived lower risk, kind of certainty, that sort of thing. And it I think for you, especially how you grew up, that kind of balance and backdrop was especially geared towards the certainty and, you know, lower perceived risk side of the spectrum. And you, the drive to the other side was so strong in you that you were able to overcome it. Not only is that hard for kind of average person and average kind of background and growing up, but in particular for you and, you know, the kind of cultural background and push towards certainty and lower risk. Do you have a sense, and we don't need to go down this rabbit hole too much, but do you have a sense for what the driver is of that desire for certainty and kind of lower risk in particular in the Asian American community?
I wouldn't want to define that across the entire Asian American community. I think it's specific to just kind of what my parents knew, right? Because there are some great, culturally great entrepreneur ethnicities. I think the Vietnamese Americans are entrepreneurial, like to the core, right? And so brave, you know, going out and seeing, you know, just kind of what industry they didn't want to be in and just getting after it. I think it was really just my parents and their families' lack of tolerance towards risk. You know, it was just them trying to be safe and not risk much because there was already so much risk coming to America and trying to raise a young family. And it was like what they knew. They just kind of understood how important education was because no one can ever take that away from you, as you've heard, right? So I think that's the crux of it.
Yeah, that's great. That's powerful. And I think it's a very good point not to kind of extrapolate to a broader community, but in particular your experience. So I appreciate you sharing that. So you've sold this business, but it doesn't feel as, you know, in some ways it feels like a victory and in some ways it feels like just a kind of stop along the journey. How did you decide what to do next? What, you know, on day zero plus one, what did you do?
How did I decide? And, you know, this is where I give my wife so much credit as part of us being successful together. You know, her background is in early childhood education and she got a job at a really prestigious early childhood school in LA. And, you know, she just realized at the time that there were not a lot of educationally appropriate toys and books for 0 through 5. I think there wasn't a lot of attention built around that. As an example, all you would see on toy shelves were Barbies and Hot Wheels and, you know, everything very gender specific, not geared towards learning and social building and, you know, everything related to kind of 0 through 5, what you see today that we take for granted. And so she's like, you should start a company bringing all of these things together and essentially trying to sell it online. I think, you know, Amazon at the time was just becoming really big. I mean, eBay was huge. And so I said, sure, that sounds like something that I can possibly do, you know? And so I just essentially went and did a lot of research and trying to understand what that looked like. And I think there were a lot of companies in Europe that were doing it right. You know, the Haba toys of the world, the Melissa and Doug's, just really high-end, high-quality, beautiful toys paired with amazing children's stories. And a big inspiration at the time was a bookstore called Storyopolis in Beverly Hills. And we wanted to kind of be a competitor to that in a different way. And so I essentially started that company to sell children's books and toys that focused on 0 through 5 and with a twist with educationally appropriate toys and books. And that was all because of my wife's career in that industry. So that's how I got to the next thing.
What did that look like when you got started? Did you have to do research on what the right toys were? Did you have to buy inventory? Did you rent a space?
I went to my first industry expo, as what most people do, I guess. And so went to all the toy expos around the country and started to learn about that. I learned how to sell things online, you know, through all the big channels at the time, which was eBay was number one. Amazon barely was getting started. They were still just a bookstore. And trying to just sell things through my own website and just different channels. But we essentially just started being a really large eBay seller. I don't even know what you would call them now, but really like, you know, like a platinum eBay seller. And then eventually having our own website, selling a bunch of toys, and then eventually having brick and mortar. And then realizing that, I wasn't really learning much. I was still the smartest guy in the room, and I never really had someone that was coaching me or mentoring me. I reference back to even the sale of my first business. I couldn't turn to my dad and ask him like what to do. And so I figured that I was still young enough. I didn't want to be in my 30s or have kids or in my 40s and realize that I'd never got an opportunity to learn from a world-class corporate executive or be a part of a world-class global brand. And so that was kind of the pivotal moment, of me being in my business and recognizing that I hated being the boss for the first time.
What about it did you, I didn't mean to interrupt, but what about it, was there a specific moment that you realized that, or was that a gradual recognition, or what was kind of the catalyst for that shift in your mind? And was it a total shift, or was it a just opening up, like maybe I should consider this more?
Yeah, I think, a lot of my peers were getting their MBAs, or they've just finished getting their MBAs. And, now they've got 5 or 6 years under their belt working for a larger company, or, they've just finished their residency or whatever it may be, but they're kind of in that next stage of their careers where they've learned, they've been able to be mentored, they've learned some sort of craft. And I felt that there was no one that taught me anything. I just kind of was self-taught, and I wanted that opportunity to be able to learn from someone that I respected and that I thought was smarter than myself.
So you have this kind of inflection point and recognition. What do you do next? How do you find, what did that inform for what you did next in terms of looking for individuals or companies or opportunities?
So then I stuck to my guardrails and I said, I don't think I would have a hard time getting a real job, a respectable job at this point. I don't know. I didn't feel like my ego would allow me to start from the ground up, but I wanted then to be able to make an impact on a global brand. I didn't want it to be local. And so I did a bunch of research and I said, you know what? If my personality doesn't allow me to work for someone, but I wanted to learn from someone, I felt like I needed to be a licensee or a franchisee of some sort of brand that was that had a global presence. And so I created a data sheet and I tiered everything out. And eventually, I put metrics in where, a company had to be around for 25 years. It had to have some point of resiliency, a global presence. I mean, there are all these things.
This is a very MBA approach for non-MBA, by the way.
Yeah, it was a very MBA approach to figuring out what this company could be. And tier one, as an example, was like Ritz-Carlton. Being a Ritz-Carlton licensee, tier two was like Mercedes-Benz auto franchise. And then the best of tier three was McDonald's. And in each of those, there's different categories, but, those were the bright, shining star of each of those industries. And I said, I definitely, at 25 years old, don't think I could be a Ritz-Carlton franchisee. And I definitely didn't think that I could be a Mercedes-Benz franchisee. But I really thought that I could be a McDonald's franchisee. And so I applied online and I got a rejection notice. And so that's when I realized that maybe I didn't have any experience in the restaurant industry. I never worked at McDonald's or fast food in my life. And maybe I didn't have enough money, right? Maybe I didn't qualify through those two things. And so that's essentially what led me to the idea of trying to maybe start, you know, with a smaller concept like a Subway or a Quiznos. And so I went out and I got approved, went through the process to be approved to be a Subway franchisee. A tropical smoothie franchisee was another one. And the last one was Z Pizza. And so I really went through the legwork and the process of understanding what those smaller franchises were like. And at that kind of tipping point where I was ready to sign the contract with Subway, my mom calls me up and says, "Hey, I saw this ad in the local Chinese newspaper, and they were selling a boba tea franchise in the city that I grew up in Arcadia." He says, "Do you want to take a shot at this? And it maybe checks all your criteria." And so I go and I check out the business. I realize that I used to go here in high school, and you know, it seemed like a very small risk, low risk business. It was already running and they had a team in place. And at the time I was like, sure, I'm going to go and be an investor. I still love the toy business and still running the toy business. And I'm going to go put some money in this business and learn alongside my investment. And so I basically put all that other work aside with Subway, Tropical Smoothie Cafe, Z Pizza, and I borrowed some money from friends and family, and I purchased my first tea franchise. And I don't even remember what year this was, but that was my first foray into being a franchisee.
Was it a single location?
Single location. I think at the time they had about 70 stores. And I'll never forget it, but the first day, this was very mom and pop franchise from Taiwan. Didn't really have a lot of resources or systems in place. And so didn't really have a training that I had to go to other than one or two days at their corporate office. And so when I walked into the store on the day escrow closed, the team came up to me and said, "Hey, we're going to give you 10 days and we're going to hand over the keys." And I said, I didn't understand why. And the reason was because they culturally, even though I was Chinese American, I didn't speak Mandarin, and that was their primary language. And that wasn't something that I understood. And they didn't feel like it was a cultural fit for them, even though I looked the part. And so they didn't want anything to do with me. And so at that point, I realized, oh my God, I'm going to be the guy that opens the door in the morning and the guy that locks the door at night. And I needed to figure out how to solve this situation quickly. And it was that point where my life completely changed. You know, I convinced a couple of people to stay with me, but essentially I had to stop doing what I was doing with my toy business, just stop doing it and focus 100% on this tea business, because I was the guy that literally woke up at 6 a.m, went to go buy supplies, pack that in my car, drive it to the tea store, unload it, and just get to work and shut the business down at night and do it all over again the next day. And unfortunately, we were open 365 days of the year.
Woo! Welcome to the jungle.
Yeah. It was those moments that I had to reach deep down in that I learned early on that I was talking about, which was grit and resiliency and just taking initiative. During my first day of business at my tea shop, I did $513 from 10 a.m. to midnight. And it was the first moment in my career that I understood what risk was. I thought, oh my God, I'm going to fail.
So how did, you know, what was day two like? Yeah, and day three. And so how did, obviously there was, that was a pretty significant both surprise and period probably to grit through. How did you grit through it? And what was that journey and what came next?
It was an emotional roller coaster, obviously, realizing now at the time that the hospitality industry is brutal. You know, if there's any industry that really can fast track you to understanding how visceral and important the customer experience is, I would say it's hospitality. You know, you're getting immediate feedback from the customer and realizing that every element of their experience and their journey matter, from the temperature of the restaurant or the threshold of your business, them coming through that threshold, those front doors, all of those elements matter. The music, the way the space makes them feel, the threshold greeting from the customers, the culture that they see within the customers, like all of those details mattered. And I had to learn that very quickly. So those were some of the first things that I started to attack, was just asking customers why they liked coming here, why they didn't like coming here, what was the things that they would want to see change. And, you know, it's funny, I didn't realize it at the time, but someone told me one of the first, you know, tidbits of feedback that I got was they didn't like going to the store because of the way the store smelled. And, you know, every time that they would walk in, they would smell a certain way, and they didn't want to have to do that if they were on their lunch break and had to go back to the office. I thought that was so unique at the time. But so I essentially just figured out what all of those customer reflection points were, or opportunities, and just focused on fixing them.
What was it that, because that's a very, especially at this time, you know, probably a pretty forward thing to get so close to the customer. Did you get to that by necessity or from prior experience, you know, interacting and not door knocking and, you know, being close to the customer in that regard, or at the toy store? What was it that got you to that so quickly?
I think I learned from an early age that one of my mantras in life is seek to understand and seek to be understood. And it's something that I've just carried with me before coming to any conclusion with any problem or any solution. And so I was just so curious. You know, as you hear business leaders say today, be curious, or start with the beginner's mindset. With every business that I've owned, that's kind of been my approach, and it's been the most valuable. And so knowing nothing about the restaurant industry, knowing nothing about quick service, knowing nothing about the tea business, that was my approach. I just wanted to understand, you know, why people came and why people didn't.
So it sounds like maybe more people started coming. So how did that, tell me the rest of that story, and then how did that lead to your, you know, what I think was their next, you know, franchising and brand experience was with a notably better known brand and larger franchise. But trace the next steps of the journey for me from, you know, opening the door and getting $513 on day one.
You know, working on all those customer opportunities, we refreshed everything. We refreshed our little 700 square foot store. We made it cool again. We brought back the cool. We had custom just everything in terms of uniforms and, you know, just the things that you see today, like the playlist matters and like the type of employee matters. But at the core of it was we just had friendly service, fast service at a very reasonable price point. I mean, it's the hallmarks of kind of even McDonald's. It's the common threads of most businesses that you see. It's actually really simple. And we just built on that. We didn't spend any money on marketing, and we just offered and built a reputation for quality, high standards, and fast, friendly service. And that's how we built the business over the next 3 years and just became something that the community could depend on. And that's how we got our customers back and went from the bottom of the barrel of all of their stores in the state of California to being one of the top store performing stores.
Simple. You said it was simple, but I mean, I think it's simple to know and say, but hard to actually do. So, you know, kudos to you and everyone on that team to get that done. Was it from there that you got involved with McDonald's or what?
Yeah. So, you know, I think that distraction, again, back to my undiagnosed ADHD, realizing that I got bored of the tea business very quickly once I established the team. And I said, hey, I don't want to give up on this dream. I want to remind myself that the reason why I'm in the tea business was because the ultimate goal was to get experience and earn a little bit more money to ultimately be a McDonald's franchisee. And so after 3 years, I reapplied online to McDonald's and surprisingly got the same exact response. And at that moment, I realized that the system...
The response being, we don't have any
franchising availability at the time, something like that. And I realized that let's stop being naive. And it's not necessarily about me, but maybe the system, there were a lot higher barriers to entry than I expected. And it was probably a closed system. And back to what I was explaining earlier, relationships. You know, I didn't have any relationships. I didn't have any ins. I didn't have a foot in the door to the brand. And so I realized that that's probably the only way in was to actually know someone that could put me in touch with the right person that could ultimately tell me whether or not the franchise was real. And so, you know, it's a funny story because I was at home having dinner one day and my aunt comes over for dinner and she's like, hey, John, you know, what you doing now? And I said, you know, jokingly, I'm trying to be a McDonald's franchisee. And would you happen to know anyone that works at McDonald's? And my aunt at the time, she was a school teacher. And for Asian Americans, it's very rare to want to work in fast food only because, again, you know, your parents highly promote education and education at all costs, no distractions, right? Focus on school, no one's getting a job. And so in my peer network, I really honestly didn't know anyone that even worked at a crew level. And so when I said that jokingly to her, she mentioned, you know what, John, actually my best friend's nephew is the McDonald's owner operator. And I said, oh my, I was blown away by that. And so I said, could you put me in touch with him? That would be amazing. And I'd want to ask him some questions. And the long story short, this gentleman, who I consider like a godfather to me now, was the catalyst to getting me an interview with McDonald's franchising and is kind of how I became a franchisee.
Serendipity there is amazing too. But I also feel like, just like you did at the beginning of the show, you just glossed over a lot of important stuff in 10 words. How, because I feel like there, you know, it wasn't like you got introduced and, you know, and then it's all motherhood and apple pie from there. So can you tell me a little bit more about how you went from that initial kind of relationships that you found and, you know, ultimately got in the door and, you know, executed well when you were in the door to kind of earn the right to be in the ecosystem?
Yeah, I want to also be careful that I don't disclose what I can't with the franchise process. But what I feel comfortable with is essentially, this person got me an interview with franchising, and you sit down and they tell you that at the time, really they're growing from within their own network. The relationship between the franchisee and the franchisor at McDonald's is very strong, and they already have a very strong network of franchisees and second generation of franchisees and third generations of franchisees, that they're not really looking for new franchisees. I mean, that's a very rare thing. And if anything else, they'd want to promote like an employee that wanted to fulfill their dream of becoming a franchisee, because that's something that they promote. And so it didn't surprise me that they never really answered my emails. I understood why. And they also said, hey, you know, we're not a franchise system where you can just invest in the business. You know, we promote ourselves, our franchisees, as owner operators. Not only do you own the business, but you actually have to operate the business. And is that something that you're aware of? And I said, yes, I mean, absolutely. And so part of their program was that I had to actually start from the ground up and work my way all the way through every single position at McDonald's for, you know, approximately, you know, 2 years. And wow. I had to do that without pay. They didn't pay you. It was volunteer, because obviously I wanted the opportunity and they didn't necessarily need me. And there wasn't even a guarantee. You know, I think they were very upfront about it. And they were saying, hey, if you become a franchisee or an approved franchisee, we can't guarantee you that you're going to have a restaurant available in California, because everybody wants to be in California. And so this late, or this kind of stage in my career where I've had a couple of wins, I was already established, I just got married, trying to start a family, you know, why would I want to do and put myself in such a vulnerable position of risk with uncertain reward? And it was really kind of, it fell back onto this idea that I really still had this dream of learning and making an impact on a global brand. Because if you could think about it, it's like, number one, you have to have enough money to buy a franchise. Number two, you got to work for free in every position for 2 years. And then number three, you have a very high chance of moving away from your core.
Yeah, it feels like not everyone would select into that, which, you know, maybe that's some of the purpose as well, right? Is to have some self-selection for folks that really want it and that have the initiative and, you know, grit to our conversation before to be willing to go get it.
Yeah.
So you're in California at this point, but you're in the Dallas area now in Texas. How did that happen? Was this where the opportunity ended up being?
So essentially, it's an unwritten rule, but you get, you know, three opportunities that they present to you after you become an authorized, after you become approved to be a franchisee. And the first three options, I didn't think that it was a good fit for me. It was Casper, Wyoming, Pittsburgh, and Buffalo, New York. And actually didn't think that any of those cities on the East Coast was something that I wanted at the time. You know, I've never lived outside of California. And so, you know, my dream was to buy restaurants in California. And the hard reality was, after 2 years of working at McDonald's, I might not get there, because I didn't want to move to the East Coast, or I didn't want to move to a small town. And I didn't realize that, you know, that it was just super rare for new franchisees to get any restaurants that were in key major tier one cities like New York, Miami, LA, San Francisco. But like I said, in so many ways that my career has had these moments of serendipity, there was a very large franchisee that was leaving the system in Dallas and had to sell a lot of restaurants. And they were really looking to do this very quickly. And I just happened to be ready and available. And I remember clearly, I got a call on New Year's Day and they said, hey, we need you to fly out to Dallas to look at these restaurants if you really want this opportunity, and we need to know within 24 hours. And so January 1st, 2010, I flew out to Dallas and made a decision to buy the restaurants. And February 1st was my first day, 2010, as a McDonald's franchisee.
Man, pretty life-changing 24 hours.
It was an extremely life-changing year, because I tell you, I sold my business, my tea business, My wife was pregnant with our first child. I moved out of state. I never lived anywhere other than in Arcadia. And I bought a new business and started a new business all within the first year.
Wow. 2010 was a big year in the Chan household.
Yes.
That's awesome. So tell me more about how, you know, beyond that year, how have you built? What have been kind of the keys to being a successful operator? What lessons have you learned along the way? I know, or I believe you've tried some different kind of innovative things, maybe learning from your tea business playbook. What have you found? What have you learned? And you know, how have you kind of built within the ecosystem, both learning from a global brand, but also impacting that brand?
I think our success, or actually I believe our success, truly hinges on some really simple things, which is make sure you have a relentless desire to be better. You know, fundamentally, I think on a day-to-day basis, we are constantly in the same mindset of this, you know, pursuit of perfection, doing things the best that we possibly can be at every moment, every day. That's number one. Number two, we put culture on the P&L. I've been an operator that has always taken, you know, actually performance over profit, people over profit. We're constantly, you know, reinvesting and putting our money where our mouth is if it does right for the business and if it does right for our people and if it does right for our company culture, that comes first. And then lastly, I would say it's just those simple things of what applied in every one of my businesses, which is listening and being a great steward to the customer. You know, I've become such an advocate to the customer experience, and it's unique in every brand, and it's what your ethos is, and it's what your brand's identity is that you have to kind of be a steward to. But, you know, simple, stupid, which is people want great, fast, friendly service at a reasonable price that they find value in. And that's just kind of what we focus on day to day.
What does that second one in particular look like in terms of, you know, putting culture on the P&L is how you framed it? Is it, you know, what ways does that manifest in what you do either day to day or month to month, or, you know, when you're looking at the P&L, how does that actually happen in the business?
I think it's just investing in a lot of things that drive your company culture. You know, we try to create a destination or a place of employment that's desirable. And it could be in so many different ways that people have done across the board. And for us, I think where we have found the most success is challenging that status quo. So working at Archfellow is less about working at McDonald's than it is about Archfellow. And what are some of those things that people would not expect a fast food franchise Z to be? So, you know, we've created an experience that is like an internet startup company, but you happen to sell burgers. Or it might be an experience that promotes a healthy lifestyle. Right. And so, you know, we do things like that where we have company branded yoga, free company branded yoga clothing that they can have. You know, we bring in speakers that are not related to our industry that want to coach our team members about different fundamentals, like understanding charities in different ways or conscious capitalism. You know, just different things like that I can't really describe. But, you know, we bring chefs in to teach them cooking classes not related to fast food, but for fine dining. We have book clubs. Just do things like that, that build a place of desire and build an environment that's almost a juxtaposition to what they think working at McDonald's is.
Before we get to kind of the last standard question, and I could ask you questions for hours, but you've got a day job to go to, and I appreciate you taking the time. But before I get to that kind of last question, how has that percolated into, you know, the I guess probably like a talent development program. Do you have a talent development program? You know, are you out there recruiting people and then kind of putting them into different locations? How does that manifest back to how you think about kind of the human capital and the people in the business that are helping build with and alongside you?
Everyone says that successful McDonald's is essentially a people business. And I agree, we are a people business. One of the most important things that we do is our strategy around succession planning and talent development, to your point. You know, we always start by hiring right, as they all say. But more than anything, it is investing in those that are willing to invest in you. You know, I think in our business, it's easy to just need a job. And it's kind of where we have been, you know, self-aware and where the tagline actually came from when I was working on our people initiatives for McDonald's global or in the US anyways. And we coined the term America's best first job. And that's, in my opinion, it's just being honest and transparent and self-aware that, hey, we might not be the best job, but we would love to be everyone's best first job. And as long as you are coming to McDonald's understanding that, you know, you're willing to make that investment in learning what it's like to have a job, this could be a great place for you. I truly believe that McDonald's is one of the most democratic brands in the world, where you can come to the brand without even a high school diploma and end up becoming a McDonald's owner operator. I mean, that is pretty spectacular. And so it's just testament to this, you know, why it's so important that this journey from day one is the most important thing that we focus on from, you know, a management perspective and a leadership perspective, to say, we need to take that time. We really need to make sure that we're investing in every part of employees' journey through McDonald's.
That's awesome. Well, there's no better spot to end it than that, I think. So I asked the same kind of closing question of everyone who I have on, and it's goofily modeled off after a take a penny, leave a penny dish at a convenience store. So I'll ask you, what is, in terms of leaving a penny, what is, you know, a piece of advice or a book or a trick or a tactic? You've had quite a journey, and I'm sure it's clear you learned a ton along that journey. What would you kind of share back with our community? And then the second part of the question is, how can we help you? What penny can our community provide to you? So would love to hear that, both those from you.
I said it once earlier, but I would say challenge the status quo is probably one of the most important things that I've learned, that I think about every single day. What I would take, that's me giving a penny, right, Dory? Hopefully, maybe half a penny. What I would want to take is, I'm always looking for honest feedback. And I would love to actually continue to learn from people of different industries, because I don't know if I've really solved my problem of being the smartest guy in the room in my mind. And I don't know if you ever solve that as an entrepreneur. I think people like to acknowledge that they surround themselves with people that are smarter than themselves. But at the end of the day, as an entrepreneur, you're making the final decision. And so that's what I would ask for, you know, continued mentorship in areas or even in the same area that, and giving me perspective that I might not see.
That's awesome. Well, you've clearly learned a lot and are hungry to continue learning. So thank you for being on the show. I really enjoyed it. And like every time I do this, I learned a lot more about you than I knew to begin with. So grateful for you coming on.
Dory, thank you so much for your time. It's such an honor. I love this podcast. Like I said, I've had so many takeaways. So I feel like I owe you more pennies.
I appreciate it. And you've left plenty here for the community. So I appreciate that.
Thanks again.
Thanks everyone for joining us. We hope you enjoyed the episode. To join the Built to Outlast community and access episodes, show notes, and other community resources, please visit builttooutlast.com. If you have or know a business that may be sold and care who the buyer is, or want to build a business and care who you do it with, please visit enduring.co to learn more about us, our long-term approach, and our holding company.